It's Tim and Tom with Tim Bradstreet and some guy you've never heard of. Until now.
Well, hello, welcome to the premiere episode of the Tim Bradstreet Podcast. I am Tom Racine, and you have never heard of me. I'm here with Tim Bradstreet, comic book artist extraordinaire, here on the very first podcast. Welcome, Tim.
Hi. Hi, everyone. You know, here's the thing, Tom. I think we have to come up with, we have to have a show title.
We do need a show title. Actually, let's put it out there. Let's see if anybody's actually listening to this. They should write in and whatever we like. I was thinking the Tim Bradstreet Experience or something like that. Or
a contest might be the worst way to try to get a title for the show.
This is true. Yes. We can, I'll give them something from your studio, like some of your cigarettes or something.
That'd this is Blood cool. Red Guts with Tom and Tim. Something like that.
Something like that. Yeah. Anyway, so we're here to talk about various aspects of the comic book world, but also, of course, movies and anything that strikes our fancy, maybe even some sports thrown in, just because we like sports occasionally.
That's, and we're going to... That's Tom. He'll be your commentator. I'll be your color guy.
When I switch my Marv Albert voice, we'll go into the sports thing. We thought we'd start off with some comics, a general discussion, though, and I'd like to start off with, actually, what kind of got you started into this whole thing? Because we all have our influences when we were kids. What was some of your earlier memories that sent you down this road?
Wow, good question. The earliest thoughts of this I have are you know, you get together with your friends, and my friends had comics. Mm-hmm. You know, I think I was introduced to it through other people, maybe older kids. And so, yeah, I just grabbed a hold of it. It was, like, totally up my alley. And
What are some of the ones you remember first?
One of the guys up the street from me, Tim Breen, used to, he was a DC guy. Yeah. So he had Superman Family, Batman Family, Legion of Superheroes, stuff like that. And so I got introduced to Mike Grell, you know, when he was doing Legion. And, you know, a slew of different guys on Batman Family and Superman Family, but the one that really stuck out to me was Michael Golden doing in Batman Family. He did Man-Bat.
Man-Bat.
Yeah, Man-Bat. And it was really cool because, you know, Man-Bat, you know, the way Golden drew it, it was like a real bat head on this guy. It was just cool. So cool.
I was wondering, it's always funny to me how it's sort of like we were talking earlier about Mets and Yankees fans. It's like you were DC or you were Marvel at that point. Because my brother collected Marvel and that was it. I didn't even read a DC comic until I was probably in my, you know, high school years.
Yeah.
Everything before that was Iron Man, Spider-Man, X-Men, and all that kind of stuff.
That's the way it was. And then I had a guy who lived behind me who was a year older than me, and he didn't live quite the... sheltered lifestyle that I did in my house. They were allowed to run rampant. They could, wow, you know, read stuff. They had like dirty records, and so it was fun to go hang out with him. But you know, I discovered Man-Thing.
Oh, Man-Thing! Yeah, yeah.
Some of the horror books, yeah, that Marvel was.
I always loved the design of Man-Thing. The three
fantastic
tendrils on his face. It was very cool. Yeah, it was,
I want to find out who came up with that, because we all know Bernie Wrightson came up with Swamp Thing,
right?
And I'm pretty sure Swamp Thing was first.
I was going to ask which came first, the chicken or the egg there, but I'm pretty sure it was Swamp Thing.
I'm pretty sure it was, yeah, Len Wein. And
it was actually the creature from the Black Lagoon, let's face it.
Well, yes.
There's always that.
Or some bad B-movie muck monster stuff that was a spinoff. But, you know, like Man-Thing, yeah, the big red eyes. And, God, speaking of Mike Golden, he did a Man-Thing cover that I remember that's just absolutely incredible.
Cool.
Just unbelievable. Mike Golden, one of my childhood heroes.
I was going to say, do any of those still exist? Swamp Thing probably still being produced by DC, or is Man-Thing still being produced? I mean, I remember that as a kid, but
Man-Thing has come back in several different incarnations. I don't know if there's a current title out, and I don't think there's a current... You know what? I think Swamp Thing is still going, because yeah. I know Jock, my buddy Jock, a British artist, was drawing a couple of issues of that.
Cool. I'm surprised they did make it into a B-movie. I remember Adrienne Barbeau in that film and her two talents. I remember that.
And, her bar and her,
yes,
bow.
I love Adrian.
Former wife of John Carpenter.
John Carpenter, that's right.
That's why that was the real reason we worshiped that cat.
Pretty much,
It wasn't the movie. No, it was the movies. Yeah.
it was the movies, let's face it. Don't get me started on John Carpenter.
I mean, once you see Adrian Barbeau in Creepshow,
yeah.
you know what it'd be like to be married to her.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, not fun. Poor Hal Holbrook.
You were a DC person all the way through? Did you ever read Marvel later? Or?
No, you know, I got introduced to DC first, and I was into it, but I went Marvel very quickly. And, you know, oddly enough, when I was a kid, it was the X-Men that roped me in. And this is post-Neil Adams, post-Dave Cockrum. My first issue of X-Men was 113.
So that's the new X-Men with
It was the new X-Men. Yeah. It was Bernon Austin, and it was 113 was Magneto had captured all the X-Men and had them on his asteroid moon.
Asteroid M.
It was absolutely just blew my mind.
John Byrne was probably the first guy that I was blown away, you know, because I mean, I remember seeing the old stuff, John Romita and all those guys, John Buscema, but John Byrne was sort of like new when I was starting to read, and I loved his art. I emulated his style all the time.
When I was first reading comics, I don't really think I noticed the art that much, and I thought Stan Lee drew everything. And, I read a ton of Kirby stuff.
Yeah.
And when I got kind of interested in art and comic book art, the guys that I really loved were Byrne and Jim Starlin and P. Craig Russell, mm-hmm. and you know that whole crew of guys, Marshall Rogers, who's another one, Frank, the guy who used to do Doctor Strange back in the day, Frank Brunner,
yeah.
or Bruner, however you say it, George Perez, guys like this.
Yeah,
Perez. And when I kind of latched on to that kind of more dynamic style, I went through a phase where I absolutely hated Jack Kirby. I was like, oh, this sucks.
I did the same thing.
I came back around, though.
Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, I just was like, ah, these guys are terrible. And then you gain an appreciation later.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you study and you go, oh, my God, these guys were pioneers. You know, they're amazing.
I never knew. And I hated Ditko.
Yeah.
And I hated Carmine Infantino.
Yeah.
And, Don Heck. Right. I hated all those guys.
But then you come back to it and you go, oh, okay, well, they were breaking new ground.
Well, you know what really
Kirby was so genius in his, you know, the things he came up with. And
what turned me around was I started reading, of all things, out of the Kirby lexicon, Captain America and the Falcon.
The Falcon.
With Mike Royer inking him at the time. And
he had the cheesiest outfit, the Falcon.
Issues that I had. I just thought it was cooler than hell.
What, really?
Yeah, I thought it was weird.
I love that he had a black psychiatrist. It was cool. I grew up learning, hey, they're just, you know, they're buddies. I thought that was cool. I thought it was a great racial thing. But I was, I thought his outfit was like, you know, here, shoot at me. Don't look at Captain America. You know,
I had the actual, did Mego come out with them, the action figures
back
in the day?
Yeah,
I had the Falcon action figure. I was very happy with that. It actually had the wings sewn into it, like material with the print pattern of the wings on him. I thought that was cool. I was the only guy in my block with a black doll. And I didn't care.
You were a pioneer.
That's right.
A true pioneer.
I marched with Martin Luther King. No, I was the first kid on my block to have a black superhero doll. They didn't have Black Panther. They didn't have Black Lightning. And except for Power Man and Falcon, they all had to be black.
Yeah.
You know, it was like
black something. So just to point that out, just in case you hadn't noticed that they were black, it was Black Falcon.
Like lesbian Wonder Woman, just in case you didn't.
Okay. Yeah, they were going to change his name to White Spider-Man, but they decided not to do that. So,
so ridiculous. But, you know, they were kind of, you know, at the same time, to defend that slightly, it was kind of spawned out of the whole 60s blaxploitation kind of angle.
Yeah, well, Luke Cage is totally that way. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. So
why hasn't that been made into a movie? I mean, that is just like rife for being made into a movie. Luke Cage, Power Man, come on.
Yeah, well, they were working on an Iron Fist movie. I mean, I know this isn't Power Man.
But Iron Fist is easier. That's just a kung fu film. But Luke Cage, I mean, I think Luke Cage could actually be a really gritty, pretty cool 70s film. But I think you have to keep him in the 70s, too. I think it's definitely got to be that.
That would be great. Yeah. With the Daughters of the Dragon.
Yeah, it's got to be the whole thing.
Bottom
pants. Oh, that'd be rock. God. And not do it campy. Do it serious. You know,
I'll tell you what. I never read the Power Man books. I think I had a couple. I wasn't into the art. Ron Wilson was one of the artists. Billy Graham, not to be confused with the Evangelist.
Well, later on, he would become.
Billy Graham was one of the artists. And later, I found out Ron was black. I don't know about Billy Graham, but Ron was black. So that must have been a really awesome experience.
For him.
To get to do that book.
Talk about groundbreaking. That must have been really pretty cool.
Totally. But I'll tell you, for my money, I was always Power Man, Iron Fist.
Yeah, I remember those. And
Cary
I love those.
Gamble.
I thought that was a great combination. They were just so different. And again, I think it actually is one of those things where you get hokey about it. But I thought it was a great racial thing. I just like, hey, these two guys are just fighting together. I never thought about them as any racial divide or anything. I just thought it was really cool.
Well, I think like Iron Fist had joined the Heroes for Hire thing. So like Luke Cage is like your Jake Giddies, you know. Yeah. It's kind of like their own version of Chinatown. And
forget it, Luke. It's Harlem.
But I mean, that spun me. You know, I think what got me to Power Man and Iron Fist was an issue of Iron Fist that Byrne drew, and I got into Iron Fist. And then Cary Gamble back in the early '80s, mid '80s, he kind of drew a little bit like Byrne. He would draw a lot more. I mean, he was definitely his own guy. But it was easy for me to bridge to being a huge fan of John Byrne.
Yeah.
And I had a ball with that title.
I loved
the hell out of that one.
The John Byrnes, all the when he did Fantastic Four, I thought that was a great run too.
Cause you know, he came under a lot of fire for that.
Really? Why?
Well,
because I always thought that was a great. I mean, I really liked the direction the stories were going, and it was an exciting time for Fantastic Four. I was never a huge Fantastic Four fan, but when he was doing it, I thought it was pretty cool.
I did too. I agree with you 100% because and Byrne's whole thing was when he went back to Fantastic Four off X-Men. Well, he left X-Men, so it really broke a lot of people's hearts, me included.
Yeah.
And when he went to Fantastic Four, I went with him.
I think it was probably the reason I picked it up. Actually,
he had the whole idea of what he was going to do with Fantastic Four was it was going to be back to basics.
Mm-hmm.
So that first cover is like that throwback cover, to the first Fantastic Four issue,
right?
And or maybe that came later. I'm not quite sure. I'm trying to scan my mind for what that first.
It was early on, yeah.
And so, you know, he had Dr. Doom, and he had, you know, all the old.
I loved his Doom,
the cosmic stuff. Yeah. And that whole story arc, and I love the little El Diablo arc that they had in there, and Nick Fury showed up, and the Black Panther. But the reason why Byrne came under fire at that time was that everyone said, this was like common, I don't know who started this, but Byrne can't ink himself. And I don't know if that was people that were disappointed that Terry Austin was no longer along for the ride, although he was inking covers, some of them. I just remember this, and it's like everybody used to say Byrne cannot ink himself, and I was like, I think you're wrong. I think it looks fantastic.
Didn't look bad to me.
No, yeah. I loved it.
He
worked his ass off on that book.
Yeah, he
it's
must have.
Very I mean, thick. And it wasn't until later that Byrne went into that hack mode where, you know, his ego got the better of him. And
believed his own press, maybe.
He bought it all. You know, I worshipped the ground the guy walked on until I met him.
Really?
Yeah, and that was
ooh,
that
controversy. Was, controversy.
No, that was it for me. I don't. You know, if Byrne ends up hearing about the fact, I mean, I've made it public before. He was a complete asshole.
Oh, it's too bad.
And
I hate hearing that.
And I gave him another chance later. I mean, not like he was depending on me to give him another chance. He had no idea.
That's right. He was looking to you for absolution.
It was actually Ron Wilson at that same. I was at a Creation convention in 1984, I think, or 83, and the guests were John Byrne, Walt Simonson. Ron Wilson and Byrne and Ron Wilson had just done one of the first graphic novels. It was like Death of Captain Marvel, and there were like four other ones, and then there was Super Boxers.
Yeah.
And
I remember Death of Captain Marvel. I thought it was great.
Yeah, Byrne wrote it, and Ron Wilson drew it, and I think Armando Gill, who was a fantastic inker, inked it, and it was like Ron Wilson really never looked better. And so, and there were a couple other creators there too. The whole Justice Machine crew, the Chicago crowd of artists, Bill Reinhold, Bill Willingham at the time. I think Bill Willingham was living in Lake Geneva, working for TSR at the time. But
you know too much.
Hey,
you do.
I was.
You are like a comic savant. Sometimes.
I absorbed everything at that time. I'm way off the pulse of that now. But at the time, I knew everything that was going on.
See, it's funny because it's like, you know, it's I absorbed it. I really got it, but I didn't get it to that level. It's sort of like, you know, I knew most of the artists who were doing stuff and didn't really follow some of the writers, which is too bad because obviously most of the time the comic that keeps you is because it's written really well too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I feel bad that I don't remember a lot of their names or knew a lot of their names, but yeah.
This was post Frank Miller's run on Daredevil, so he had just come out with Ronin.
Yeah.
And so that was out, and Walt Simonson had just taken over Thor, Byrne had just taken over Fantastic Four. So it was an exciting time, actually, in college.
Yeah, yeah, it was
And
a golden age.
Burn was a jackass.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Moving from childhood favorites, because we can go on after a while, and we'll probably come back to that eventually, because I'm sure we have some real favorites back in the day. But how about some current favorites? I mean, I I'm actually in full disclosure mode. I haven't followed comics per se in a long time. I mean, it got to that point, what everybody does, where it's not so much that I grew up, is more that I couldn't afford it anymore. They got to the point where they were not 25 cents anymore. They were $17 or whatever. And I pretty much had to give it up. And so for years, I just didn't even follow. And then I started going back into comic book stores to see what the art was like and stuff. And I'm slowly getting back into it. And I love all the diversity of it. But I am certainly no expert today on what's out there. Do you even have the time? I mean, your deadlines, all the things you work on. Do you even have the time to read other stuff? And if you do, what's some of your favorite stuff right now?
Bad Planet.
There's just one. It's called Bad Planet.
No, that's
we'll come back
true.
To Bad Planet.
My favorite stuff right now is, well... I'm not, like I said, my finger's not on the pulse anymore, but I have to believe that right now the comics industry is all, can I use the phrase, a giggle?
A Twitter?
I think that, and I don't know this for sure, but I have to assume that the comic industry right now is just a flutter.
There you go, a flutter. We like that.
Over Jay Lee's work on The Gunslinger.
Mm.
It's absolutely fantastic. And I'm sure he's going to have his detractors too, like, okay, well, he doesn't really draw any backgrounds, and every page is like a really simple, and he doesn't know how to story tell. Or bullshit. It's absolutely gorgeous, and it's I don't think it's anything close to like form over well, whatever the current what is that?
The
looks over it's
form,
the thing that,
form follows function.
Yeah, well, it's what Ridley Scott used to always come under fire for. This he was all about the visual and
substance
and,
over style.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Everyone
or style,
might
over substance.
Style over substance. Yeah. Yes, and I don't care because it's amazing stuff, and and it's being reproduced from pencils, and so you can't mention Jay Lee's name without, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce this right, Richard Isonove. Is a note. I have no idea. I apologize for butchering that.
Yeah.
But that guy's incredible. You know, that team is incredible. And I saw some of Jay Lee's. Jim Daly was showing me online that some of these pencil pieces are for sale. The cover illustration, it's just pencils, mind you, of issue one, sold on $7,500.
Wow. And that's fairly recent.
That's overpriced as much as that guy paid way too much for that.
Yeah,
because there's better pieces, and you can, and most
but
of
it is issue one, so maybe he's thinking, eventually.
I never care about that stuff like that. So, collectors, I'm not speaking your language, but I always go for the best piece if I can. The best piece at the best price. And there are a lot of other pieces there, all in the $2,500 range.
Yeah.
That I'd consider buying. I mean, there's a couple that I'd be like, wow. And if I could get anyone to draw Red Sky Diary, I'd get Jay Lee to do it.
Yeah.
A, because I think he could really, I mean, we have the same kind of sensibilities. He's a lot more pretty than I am. But his work's just amazing, and I think it's fantastic. The book's cool. Got to be, it'll win Eisner's, no question. The other thing that I'm just super giddy about is anything that which right now would be Hellboy. I'm sorry, not Hellboy. The BPRD books, the miniseries that Mignola is kind of spiritually guiding it right now. Mm-hmm. But it's written by John Arcudi, old friend from back in the Dark Horse days, who created the Mask.
No, yeah.
And, worked with Dark Horse for a long time. For a good chunk of time from, I think, the start of Dark Horse.
Mm.
And one of my favorite illustrators, and he's been one of my favorites for 20 years, a guy who's been incredible since day one, and he's been working in the medium and working on high-profile projects from his own Baker Street back in the early 80s. To things like Sandman Mystery Theater for a really wonderful run, Guy Davis.
Mm.
An overnight sensation after 20 years of business. Because
that's how it usually is.
Yeah. Well, another reason, and it's like this is very important. It's the coloring. Dave Stewart's coloring in those books on Guy Davis. Guy's never looked better.
Mm.
I mean, it's absolutely stunning. And of course, Mignola's tickled, you know, with having this in Guy's hands and John Arcudi's hands. So, yeah, those two books right now are my favorites.
I was going to toss this question in, and it's the sort of desert island disc type of question. But if you, right now, it's not maybe not so much actually, but if you could take over, you yourself, if somebody said you can have any superhero slash comic book at all, anything you want to do, who would you take on? Who would you want to write and draw right now? Any character or anything from any time?
Wow. Well, if I was going to do it, I'd do Red Sky Diary. But I'm probably not going to draw that myself. Not the whole thing anyway. I'm really, really, if you're listening, Daniel Zizej, I'm coming for you. I think I want to get Daniel Zizej to draw it. I'm really so...
You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah. Well, I've talked about it a little bit with another cat, but I didn't decide this until like yesterday. But I've been thinking about a guy, and of course I was thinking about Jay Lee, but he's going to be very expensive and probably busy for the rest of his life.
Bastard.
So I want to go kind of in the opposite direction with it. And originally I thought I want to do it very realistically. But you think about it, that's if I do it.
Right.
And I'm so in love with Daniel Zizej's work, and you'd know Daniel from Congo Bill and El Diablo at Vertigo. And I believe he's done some stuff for Marvel, too. But this cat should be, like, on... They should have him under contract, and they don't. So I'm going to put him under contract. But that's to take a personal kind of aside to that question. Right. If I could draw any book and help with the story and be involved with it on that level...
Right.
I'd either do Cal McDonald, which is the Criminal Macabre series at Dark Horse, a character I'm absolutely in love with, or I'd really love to do a Nick Fury book.
Really?
Yeah.
The old Nick Fury or the new
My Nick
universe?
Fury. Yeah. My yeah. Nick Fury.
The one we grew up with.
Yeah. Well, actually, I should say Captain America. Now, yeah. I'm not a big gung-ho Captain America fan. I don't like read Captain America.
He's dead, you know.
Yes, wearing a Punisher skull. Who gives a toss? But I'll tell you, I used to read Captain America when John Byrne used to draw.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, when
yeah.
Kirby drew it, and then Kirby Byrne drew it. Right, yeah. But I love Captain America, but I don't, you know, I'm not a diehard. And what I wanted to do is, when Bruce Jones was over at Marvel, we were trying to work on a project together, and I pitched Bruce an idea. And the idea was that the Super Soldier, this is what it would be called. It would be called Captain America. It would be called the Super Soldier. And it would be about Steve Rogers. Now, Steve Rogers is like 65, 70 years old, okay? He's like a Clint Eastwood 65 or 70. And he's got the gray hair, just a little bit of blonde left in it. And he's retired. But he knows all these secrets, right? These coups d'etats, all this stuff dating back to World War II. And what I wanted to do was put it in a situation where the government became afraid of the knowledge that's in this guy's head. Hmm. And so what they did was they sent a hit squad after him. Now, this is Steve Rogers running around as a civilian, but very much rooted in that secret agent type of world. So he's wearing this trench coat. And he doesn't really wear the costume underneath it, but he keeps the shield on his back under the coat, so he's got the shield that he can still use as a weapon. And what he does is the government sends this hit squad after him, thinking he's just this old man, right? And, of course, they botch it, and Steve Rogers is anything but a milquetoast old man, and he whips the crap out of him. I mean, he might almost get killed. I mean, it's going to be he's an old guy, right?
Right,
so,
right.
And these guys are no... turkeys that they send after him. It's a legitimate bunch of dudes, right? So Cap probably, you know, comes close to losing that one, but he wins. And then he's on the lam. He's, you know, he doesn't have a safe house or anything like that. He never thought about this contingency, and he ends up going back. Nick Fury's retired. But Steve Rogers knows where Nick is. They still kind of keep in touch. So, you know, through clandestine messages and stuff like that. And so I want to use that whole, like, shield wall, you know, like when you walk into the alley and the wall looks solid, but you walk through it kind of thing. Yeah. I want to bring that back because I think that's really, really cool, you know. So Steve goes there, and he hooks up with Nick, and he tells Nick what's going on. And, of course, Nick's like, I don't know anything about this, but let me see what I can find out. So Nick kind of becomes the inside man. Nick's retired too, but he just... you know, I was going to come up with a way that he'd still be at S.H.I.E.L.D. headquarters, like as a consultant or something like that. Right. They just threw him on a desk, you know, and tried to put him out to pasture.
An honorary position, so he's pissed off,
you know, and so, you know, try to work that way and then have these two guys try to battle back and take these dudes down. And
that was a cool
idea. Bruce loved it, and but then Bruce left Marvel. So it didn't happen, and it would have been a big series for me. So I it was something that I didn't know if I was ready to do, but it's something that I'd like to.
Yeah,
Deathlok is another one I'd really love to do.
Oh, I always loved Deathlok. Yeah, it was a fun character, especially when Byrne drew him for a while, didn't he? I mean, it was he showed up in, what did he show up in? See, now I'm blanking, but I remember Deathlok. Showing up, I just love the fact that dead cyborg from the future was just kind of a cool idea.
I go back to Astonishing Tales with featuring Deathlok with it was Rich Buckler and Klaus Janson.
Yeah,
and
I do remember those too. Yeah,
I read those when I was in sixth grade. I ended up stealing the comic books from my classroom. My teacher was really cool, and he had like a science fiction bookshelf, and he had comics, and he would have this like free period during the day. Kind of this idea he'd taken from his high school teaching, but we were in sixth grade. So, but he would have this half hour a day where we could just like, we could do whatever we wanted to in the classroom. His name was Mr. Livingston. And Mr. Livingston introduced me to Dune, the Frank Herbert novels, and introduced me to...
So we had to kill him.
To Deathlok, yes. So we had to kill him. And also he had Killraven. He had all these great books in there. And
cool.
I ended up stealing them. I still have them.
Excellent. Moving on to the next thing here. Basically, this is the "What is Tim up to?" subject.
we gotta like figure out a way to like segue into.
I will. I'll have little Tim up to.
No. I don't want to like self-aggrandize. So we've gotta figure out a way to just like roll into it without making it like
not a segment.
Obvious.
Welcome to Tim's world.
No, it's
hi kids.
No, I look at it like this. It's our segment.
Ah, well, yes, it is our segment. But I'm the host. I'm here. Actually, I'm sitting. We didn't describe this. I'm actually in Tim's studio, which is very, very cool. Of course, there's artwork all over the walls and stuff piled up and cool stuff on the
propped up on the desk.
The Death Eater Frank Frazetta statue.
Death Dealer.
The Death Dealer. I'm sorry, Death Dealer. But just, I love that. That's the coolest thing in the world. But we're going to talk a little bit about what's on your plate. You've got a beautiful cover over here that you're very, very proud of. What's going on with that?
Yeah, that's the cover to Criminal Macabre, My Demon Baby, number 4.
Cool.
Dark Horse did this thing. They've started a quote-unquote regular series out of Criminal Macabre, which is the Cal McDonald book by Steve Niles.
Right. You gave me those to read. They were great.
Yeah. And you definitely got to digest that
stuff.
Yeah,
I loved it.
And another segment from the Peanut Gallery over here.
Jimmy playing poker, by the way. Hey.
Yeah, it's
how you doing over there? You kicking ass? What's going on? Yeah, okay. Yeah, that was kind of a meh thing going on.
Another classic statement.
So you get to do the covers. This is, I mean, it's very, very cool. Which issue is this? Number 4, you said?
Yeah, what they've done is it's a regular series, but it's a regular series of story arcs. Mm-hmm. And so each story arc is 1-4 instead of being Criminal Cop 1-, like 35 issues.
Oh, okay. So
it's 1-4, 1-4.
Well, that's good. Considering what I read, it's a very episodic sort of noir thing. So I think that's great. I think it'd be great to be able to, just develop the story over 4 issues and then move on to the next one. I think that's pretty cool.
Right. And so that's what it is. And when I left Hellblazer, I was looking for a gig, I was really scratching my head as to what kind of thing I wanted to do. You know, was I going to call somebody and go, hey, if you, ever need a guy, or, I was waiting to see who would call next. Cause I get jobs offered all the time. I mean, I've turned down stuff from Wolverine to the Hulk, doing regular covers on. And if you're asking yourself, I can't see Tim doing the Hulk. Well, that's what I thought too, which is why I'm not doing it. But
the man knows his limitations.
But I still didn't quite know that. Vertigo gave me Sandman Mystery Theater when I left, so I took that on as a 5-issue series. And during the time that I was working on that, Niles called me and said they're making a regular series out of Criminal Macabre at Dark Horse.
Cool.
Do you want to be the cover artist? And I, before he even got the words out of his mouth, I was saying yes.
Well, you did the cover to the paperbacks you gave me, right? I mean, at least the one of them.
I did Guns, Drugs, and Monsters.
Right. So, so there's a bit of background there, which is cool.
I did Summerstock
I played Petruchio in Summerstock. the next thing you do, you've Bad Planet 3 in 3D is out.
Yes.
And available, right?
So thanks for making that a real short and sweet segment on Criminal Macabre.
Well, that's it. That's all you get, man. Jeez, we're moving on, man. Okay. Jeez, we got people to cover.
You got to rein me in. I like it. I have to kick it.
Are you doing anything else besides the covers on that, or is that what you've got going?
Well, Steve and I are talking about doing, and I've already shot some stuff for it, he's got some unpublished short stories that he wants to do as prose, and instead of putting them out in novelette or novel form, we are going to do a big coffee table book. Cool. And make it an illustrated thing.
Wow.
And I'm going to do, like, you know, 15 full color, full page pieces.
Wow. That rocks.
with a good amount of spot illustrations in it as well. We want to make it like this cool little event.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and a prestige thing. So, that Steve and I have that in the pipeline. So
cool. You heard it here first. I'll say that a lot. Bad Planet number 3 is out, and you are currently inking number 4. You told me, right?
Yes.
Is that what's going on somewhere?
I was inking 4 the last time we talked.
It's a 700-page graphic novel.
it's only 22 pages, folks. But the thing is, you know, I'm doing this raw job inking Bad Planet, which is a full-time job. When you ink a book, it's a full-time job.
Yeah.
But
I was going to talk about that in a second. I want to see what that's
going. But I'm also the art director of Raw.
Right.
I'm also a partner of Raw. And I also have a regular job doing covers.
Right.
And then I also have a regular job being a husband and father. Great. So
you have a daughter somewhere in there.
Yes. So I'm spread very thin. So I have to, like, you know, do 10, 12, 14 pages, take a break, get 3 covers out of the way, and then get back on the job. So
he hasn't slept in 6 months. So just can you say.
I'm fighting sleep right now. But yeah, that it's keeping me very busy. I'm spread.
What other projects with Raw are you doing? I mean, the art director part of it. Are there other things you're not? I mean, super directly involved. Your art directing. What are those about?
Oh well, you know, it's I get to design all the books.
Cool.
And you know, sign off on everything and bring in the creative teams.
You have the power.
I get a lot of say. Tom obviously has final word on everything, but and sometimes he jumps the gun without me and just decides he wants this guy, even against my better judgment. But the one time that happened, he proved me wrong. So I felt like, yeah, well, you know, good. Okay. We're in good hands.
We're
so
in good hands.
But right now, it's Tom and I are spitballing these scripts for our next series, The Lycan, which is a period werewolf piece. It's kind of like the, if I had to break it down in its most simplest terms, it's kind of like the 13th Warrior meets the baddest ass werewolf movie you've never seen yet.
Cool.
And
when you first said that, I thought it was a graphic novel about you know, moss or something. I was going to say, man, you guys are pushing the edge there.
Oh,
that's
yes.
Pretty cool.
Yes, we don't stop.
Wait, we have an update from Jimmy. How'd you do? He just took him down. He took him down.
All right.
All right, good man. Right. He's playing online poker.
Play
good for
poker
Jimmy.
Poker against Jimmy online. What's your screen name, Jim?
We don't know.
It would be Big Hair. Or So yeah, we're trying to nail down, and I'm looking at guys like I really like Kike Alcatina, who inked Tim Truman on Hawkworld, and he's I believe an Argentinian artist.
How do you have time? I'm going to jump in. How do you have time to find all these guys? I mean, you're so busy. I mean, do you do this online? Do you look for their work online? Is this convention sort of thing where you meet people?
I do
or?
A little of that,
yeah.
Definitely, I mean, because you know when you've been illustrating for 20 years. You kind of fall off. Like I said, my finger's not on the pulse anymore.
Right.
I mean, I haven't been in. Well,
it's
in,
on your own pulse. That's the problem.
I was in Dark Delicacies last week, but I mean, I haven't been I never get into comic shops unless I'm doing signings. It's not any close to me. It's like I don't hang out there anymore. So
yeah.
I don't know who's currently hot. I don't know, you know, S from Shinola. But here's the thing. I see stuff anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And MySpace has really helped me out with this too. I've met a lot of young artists through MySpace.
Cool.
But no, Kike Alcatina, when Tim Truman was doing Scout and he and Chuck Dixon had started Four Winds Publishing, 3 Clips, Alcatina was one of those guys they brought in. He'd done a graphic novel or a book called Moving Fortress that was never published in the United States, and they took that material, they put it in graphic novel format and reprinted it, and it was awesome.
Cool.
And so that's how I was introduced to Kike Alcatina. And then he ended up inking Truman on a couple of things, including Hawkworld. And, you know, he just has this European style, this throwback period type style of textures and an inking style is just dynamite. And so if it's a situation where Well, you know, I'm considering having him be the artist, you know, doing everything. Mm-hmm. But more than that right now, I'm leaning towards finding a penciler that I really like and then making and then having Alcatina ink it. Mm. But, you know, I'm looking at a guy named Andy Brace, too. And if you know, Andy Brace is a young illustrator. He does mostly covers, and he's fantastic. And, he, you know, he's been sending me work since he was, you know, unpublished. And, you know, we've kept in touch over the years. And he is really, you know, him and, like, the two guys that were, you know, like, fans of my work who I met when they were just young, burgeoning, you know, like, trying to break into the business guys that have really made it. Mm-hmm. Are Andy Brace and even more so than Andy, Lee Bermejo.
Hmm.
Lee's a genuine superstar right now. Yeah, exactly. It was the same way I came up. You know, I came up showing my stuff to Tim Truman, and you know, he brought me in. And I wasn't responsible for bringing those guys in, but...
But you were, I'm sure you were a spiritual mentor.
Yeah, yeah, totally. And, you know, they'd send me their work and I'd comment.
Well, that's, that is huge. I mean, we, just to plug what I do on the other side, I have a comic strip oriented podcast, Comics Coast to Coast, and we talk to a lot of comic artists, and it's all about that. It's all about that. That's where, I mean, we all just are dying to get some sort of feedback from somebody, mm-hmm. you know, and when you get it, it's amazing. I mean, if a syndicate author, you know, I sent out my stuff and I got all the rejection notices, but one of them said, hey, this is pretty cool. We don't need a panel right now. But that was amazing to me. I mean, it really just filled me with such, I was like, wow, this is great. Somebody's reading this stuff.
Yeah.
And when you meet people at cons and when you meet an artist and they look at your stuff, it's really, really powerful, I think. And, you know, artists can really, really help each other that way. And I'm glad to hear that most of the time, most of the people I've met, especially cartoonists, have been great. They're really just laid back and they all want to help each other because we know how hard it is. And I'm assuming comic book art is similar to that. I think there's probably a little bit more ego involved than in cartooning.
I'd sooner cut your balls off than cut you a break.
There you go. No. Yeah, that's it. That's what it says on his t-shirt right now. So.
It's not that cutthroat, but I think it's a little less. I mean, you'll run into more people who aren't exactly excited to turn someone on to compete against them. But,
yeah.
You know, it's just a case of, you know, for me, it was coming full circle from me being on the other side of the table and being that guy to...
And now you are the mentor.
Well, I tell you what, I don't feel like it. I feel like I always have. I'm still fighting to you know, make my work as good as I can. And, those are the things I worry about. And it just seems surreal and odd to me when someone comes up and asks me stuff like that.
I'm sure that's probably true of anybody, though. I'm sure that Charles Schulz said the same thing. I mean, if you're a comic strip or comic book artist, you have this sort of young at heart sort of, you think you're 18 for the rest of your life anyway.
Sure.
And you'll be 65 working on something. Say, I mean, we're drawing werewolves. I mean, give me a break. You know? It's like, it's not, you know, it's not rocket science. We're not so curious, but our minds are always staying young and active.
And
I think we never think of ourselves as adults because we're not, you know? And so I turned 41. I was like, are you kidding me? 41? When did that happen?
Oh,
you know, it was amazing.
God.
It was scary. And I still feel, you know, I'm 18, just bald.
Yeah, so. I used to be the guy on the other side of the table. The guys would go, how old are you? And I'd say, 17. And they'd go, you can go to hell.
That's right. I remember being 19.
And that made me feel so good because it was guys that I really, really, you know, like...
Because it meant you were doing something right, probably.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, they were being facetious. it just made me feel... It instilled me with confidence. It made me feel good about what I was doing and the direction I was going. And that's the kind of support you can't really, you know, you can't manufacture. You have to earn it, you know?
This kind of segues into my next question because I was thinking that, you know, you've reached a power, especially with Raw, a point in your career where you're having a lot of power. And when you started off, of course, you didn't. And how has that dynamic changed for you? I mean, when you dealing with art directors and editors when you were younger, getting stuff done, do you feel it's different now that once you've reached a certain level of fame, how much more power do you have? And you now as an art director, how does that make you feel being in charge?
I don't know. The only reason I care about power is the only charm that holds for me is that no one's going to tell me what to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's creatively, that's all we care about.
That's all I care about, really. Getting to call the shots so that the seven-headed approval machine doesn't get to make that call for me and ruin something that could have potentially been fantastic.
Right.
Because generally it's people that aren't creative that are making those decisions.
Yes, especially if we start talking about films.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, it's great. But I was very lucky, Tom. When I came up, you know, I broke in games, in role-playing games. And for about 2 or 3 years, I played by the book, team player, get your illustration list, crank them out, turn them in. You know, I say crank them out. I mean, I had a pride about what I was doing.
Yeah, yeah.
I was trying to do really good work. Whether that happened or not,
but so I was trying. Someone I else was trying.
But I kind of hit a point where, you know, when I got into kind of making my stuff more realistic, where I kind of started employing the use of photos, and my work just, I mean, it was something that I just grasped onto. Mm-hmm. It was what's the word I'm looking for? It was inspiring me.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I found something that I could just really leap off of, and what's a good way to put it? The point I'm trying to make is that once I started doing that stuff and I'd started to kind of get into that after about a year, I was lucky enough that the people that I was working for kind of recognized that, A, that the work was really well received,
mm-hmm.
and B, I kind of knew what I was doing.
Yeah,
so,
which is huge when you're hiring artists.
Yeah.
It's not always the case.
So in other words, they trusted my vision. Yeah. And so what ended up happening was, instead of getting these ludicrous illustration lists, you know, like two paragraphs of describing what's going on in this quarter page illustration, just completely stupid. I went from that to them just giving me the text and going, "Come up with your own imagery."
That's cool. You're on your way at that point. That's
so
great.
I had this great freedom.
Yeah.
And that freedom followed me wherever I went.
That's great.
I've always, with a few exceptions, in comics, gotten to do whatever the hell I wanted to do.
I want to go there now because this is like the nitty gritty thing. I think a lot of people listening are probably fans, but not necessarily in the industry. How does that work exactly? Let's say you're the penciler. Let's just go back to the basics here. You're on the thing. What shows up in your FedEx? The script? How much description from the writer?
I'm on the thing. What does that mean?
You're on the thing. You are the penciler. You're the guy. Okay. So what happens? I mean, the writer sends you a script. How much details in a script? Is it just dialogue with a short thing, or does that depend on the artist?
Really depends on the writer.
Oh, okay. Because some of them are more visual. Some of them are probably just somebody punches somebody, go have fun for 4 pages.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in a really organized setup, like say you're working at Marvel, and your writer is Garth Ennis, and your editor is Axel Alonso, or, you know, one of the big guys up there, then they're going to want to lay it all out for you.
Uh-huh.
And
so there's a little bit less freedom in a place like that because...
No, they're going to direct you a little bit. I think you still have artistic freedom. There's still room to roam in there, but it's a little more structured.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're doing an independent book or you're working at IDW or you're working for one of the mini majors,
mm-hmm.
you probably have a lot more input into that. But I say that the writer has a lot to do with that because some guys don't even know that you have latitude.
Mm-hmm.
They'll just do what's there because they think that's what the writer wants, and they're just trying to please him.
Right.
And I find that asking those questions usually makes a lot of difference. You know, instead of just kind of
no dumb questions,
wandering through it and trying to wonder where you're at. Don't be embarrassed or don't feel stupid to ask.
Are scripts all over the map? I mean, you know, in television and film, there's a standard. Is there a standard in comic books that says panel one does this, panel two does this?
There's a structure to it.
Yeah.
There's certainly a structure to it. I mean, it was when, like Todd Farmer was writing Alien Pig Farm. He didn't know how to write for comics. I mean, he's a screenwriter.
Right.
So.
Yeah, very structured.
When he first turned in a script, he was describing stuff that was going to be on the page, and Niles took him aside and he just said, "Listen, you know, here's something that's just a real simple thing to keep in mind. You don't need to describe it if you're going to show it,
mm-hmm.
In the text. You don't need to, you know, you can explain that to your artist, but you don't have to explain it to the reader."
Right.
And you know, with just a couple of, you know, an hour or two, you know, talking with or sitting with Todd Farmer talking about this, Todd figured it out.
Is that usually part of the process? Do you read the script and then call the writer and talk about it for half an hour and just kind of bullshit about it?
Well, you know,
I don't
do a ton of sequential because it's a really, you know, my process is fairly laborious and or laborious or however you want to say it.
I like laborious.
I do too.
Let's go with that.
I always did like that. Yeah. It made me think of the laboratory. you know, if I do a comic book, it's like putting on a play.
Yeah.
and I'm one guy. So it's not like I have a staff of people to help me stage this play.
It's right. And your stuff is so cinematic, it's like you're directing a film, really.
I mean, it really is. Yeah. The few times I've done it, that's exactly what it's like. Yeah. I'm basically, you know, getting all the props, all the costumes, all the locations, going out to those locations with my lights, with all this stuff. And it's just really a lot of work.
Yeah.
And, you know, occasionally I get somebody to help me out with lights and stuff like that. But it's just so much work. So it really has to be, for me to do that, it really has to be a project that I know I want to spend a year, you know, a year and a half of my life working on. Right. Again, another parallel to movies.
Right.
So what I mean is that I basically primarily do covers. And but I work the same way as an interior artist might. In a lot of cases, I get a script, I read the script, I come up with a cover image. Other times, I don't have a script. So, like, a good example is when I was working on Hellblazer at Vertigo. When I first started working on it, Warren Ellis was the writer.
Okay.
And Warren would send scripts into DC, and between Warren and my art and my editor, they would come up with concepts for me. But not like ironclad. They wouldn't. Right. It wouldn't be like, do this.
Did that bug you at all, or ever, or did you appreciate the?
No, I was glad to be doing covers and comics. You know, with Unknown Soldier, I basically worked with the editor, and Hellblazer basically worked with the editor.
So the writers don't have a lot of power over that. So,
well, I don't know. You know, I don't know that Warren didn't talk to Axel, and they kind of had the plan.
So he might have been. You know,
all I knew was I was working with Axel. Yeah.
So, I mean, we could use this as an example, the one you just finished up, this gorgeous cover here. How did this come to you? I mean,
I didn't show that to anybody.
Well, see, now you're Tim Bradstreet with a capital T and a B, so you can do what you want. But
don't put it that way.
All right, capital T, small B?
Take the self-aggrandizing out of this equation. To finish my thought there with Vertigo, when Warren left the book, Brian Azzarello came on board. Now, Brian... I never got scripts, and I basically Axel left it to me and Brian. So basically, every cover was a phone call, skull session between Brian and I. And if I had a character that had never been in the book before that Brian had brought to it, I'd say, "Listen, Brian, if you were casting, if this was a movie and you were casting it, who would you cast in that part?" And Brian would say, "Like, I'd cast Yaphet Kotto as that guy." Then I had a visual reference point. And then I could run, and I could find a guy that looks like Yaphet Kotto.
Do you have to work with the artist of the penciler? I mean, what if he has a different look on the character?
Well, generally, that would fall to me because I'm doing covers maybe 2 months before the guy is doing the issues.
Oh, okay. So that's interesting to know. So the guy, the penciler, would then work from your work.
I would almost always get first pass.
Cool.
And plus, the pencilers would come and go.
Yeah.
And it was my territory. It was my book. It's weird. It's weird that a cover artist would have, you know, that's really strange, but that's the way it was. I went, while working on Hellblazer, I went through three different writers, four different editors, a slew of assistant editors. The one constant on the book was me. So people would refer to it as Bradstreet's book.
Right.
I know it's kind of strange, but... Yeah. And with the Punisher too, I Garth is Garth, you know, Garth Ennis is Garth Ennis. He's a god in this industry. But the fans are legion. I have a huge fan following from the Punisher, and you know, a lot of them think it's, you know, they tell me the reason they picked the book up is for the covers, whatever. And well, they're big fans of the Punisher too, but. You know, I'm sure I have as many detractors as fans.
Well, it is the internet world.
But I don't care about them.
That's right. They don't matter.
Well, you know, Tom, here's the thing. Bottom line, I draw to please myself.
Yeah, that's the only way it's got
to
be done.
I don't draw to please anybody else. And so if someone's got a problem with my stuff, they can take it somewhere else.
I've always said that that's rule number one for any artist of any sort. You know, musician, filmmaker, whatever. You have to please yourself first or you're going to make crap.
So. I was just reading this James Bama book, and Bama kind of talks about that, about how he never thought of himself. I mean, he, like criticism and stuff like that, was he never paid attention to it. He never heard it. He was like in his cubicle doing his cover in a half a week.
Right.
And
of course, it was a lot easier than to ignore the criticism. I mean, now you've got your raw website. You see criticism like that. 2 seconds after it comes back. I think it's probably a little harder to ignore that in the internet age. But I still think you should.
It was a point I was going to make earlier about the young artists. It's like when I was coming up, we didn't have the internet.
Right.
And I know that sounds like it was 100 years ago, but it really wasn't that long.
No, it wasn't even that long ago. Yeah.
And now there's the internet. So like I also mentioned that a lot of young artists have contacted me through MySpace, which is a really great network tool because my friend Detroit Phillips turned me onto, that allows these guys to basically put their portfolio online to a network of people.
And
it's almost better than having your website,
Yeah.
I mean, you can have your little slideshows, you can have your pick sections, which you can basically turn into galleries, and you can friend people.
There's all
contact
sorts of
them, link them to the page, boom.
Yeah.
They have, it's just one step, easy to look and check stuff out, and it becomes like this this portfolio line, you know, at the convention.
Yeah, actually, the whole web thing is something, I mean, I always feel like I'm an old codger when I talk about this, but especially in the comic strip side, there are so many guys, I mean, this is a great way to develop your stuff. I mean, these guys have their own websites, and they can, like, develop their characters and their style, and there's all these young guys out there doing stuff that's amazing, and they get immediate feedback, and they get immediate feedback from professionals, from people who are looking at this kind of stuff back and forth, and it's wonderful. I mean, I keep saying to them, I feel like I said, I feel like an old man, but it's just, like, it's unprecedented. I mean, usually we worked from our little caves and we hope to God someone saw it. Now, 3,000 people see your comic strip, and this is 3,000 more than ever would have before. So it's very,
exactly
very cool.
Exactly true. There's so many guys who have their little, independent comics that would have no voice before that have a voice. I'll tell you what, here's the rule of thumb for me, like with young artists sending me their stuff. I look at it, but I don't always respond.
Yeah, but you can't.
I can't take the time. So one thing that I can tell you young guys out there is I do look at stuff, and if it's really good, if it's tripping my trigger, I mean, even if it's not polished, I mean, even it doesn't have to be like like Richard Corbin, or it doesn't have to be Jim Lee stuff. If I can see the passion in it and I can see that you're heading somewhere, you can bet you'll probably get an email from me back.
Yeah, which is cool. Like I said, I do think that the industry is a lot more conducive to that. I do think most artists are fairly supportive of one another.
Yeah.
And in the internet age, I think it is. I mean, I told you just before on Comics Coast to Coast, I sent a random shot in the dark email out to Burke Breath at Bloom County and Opus, thinking, I'm never going to hear from this guy. And 3 or 4 days later, he wrote back. We sent questions back and forth. He was really nice. He answered them. I mean, Pulitzer Prize winning cartoonist. So I just think it's the coolest thing in the world.
So, yeah. And for, again, with the guys that send stuff in, if you don't get an email back, here's what I think. you probably need to work a little. You need to work at it. So just work at it.
You got to always keep working. I mean, you can't never expect feedback, I think is the rule. But if you get it, listen to it, because that means somebody took the time to stop and say, hey, this is worth talking to you about.
Right.
But don't feel bad if they don't.
I thank people, but you have to understand, too, that I hear, like maybe 10, 15, 20 guys a week want to send me their pitch of their idea.
Yeah, I mean, who's got time?
Or another 10 or 15 guys will want to know if I'm available to do commissions. Yeah.
By the way, I have a script in my bag.
It's just tough, and you just can't get back to everybody.
No, I mean, it's just, and that's the thing. I mean, again, if somebody writes you, they're, don't feel bad if you don't write back, because that's just, it's the same thing.
Sending, I feel bad.
Yeah,
I always feel bad when I'm
exactly.
Like, I don't have time.
You want to respond because it's, people take the time to write you. You want to say something nice. And
yeah.
I mean, even in my limited experience on doing the online comic, you get support mails, and I always try to answer them because I just think it's the coolest thing in the world when somebody writes you. But you don't always get to it. It always feels crappy. It's like, damn it, they wrote me this note.
I always feel it's in my best interest to interact with people that take the time to, like try to communicate with me.
Because eventually they will be in charge of Marvel Comics and they'll hire you back.
No, I mean, it's good karma. I mean, I don't want to alienate anybody. That's also your best. Hey, why don't you shut, what?
Poker Man has something to say. What was that?
Did you want to come in here for a second? Maybe we can bring Jim in here for this point.
Don't
he's trying.
Think that's your...
Come over here.
No,
okay. We have a question. Hold on.
Yeah. We have a legitimate.
This
question.
This is Jimmy. It was a real question from Jimmy.
But don't you think that's one of your best qualities?
Oh, that I do try to take the time with people?
That you do take the time with people.
Well, that's how, I mean...
That you understand.
Well, you know, I made a point about this earlier, about being on the other side of the table.
Mm-hmm.
And when you are confronted with that guy you do look up to, or you want to emulate for any reason, and that guy turns out to be a jackass,
yeah.
then, you know, that has impact.
Yeah.
I don't care
yeah.
who you are.
Oh,
you
it
know?
Does, totally.
Because yeah. you never know yeah. where people are going to end up. And you know, maybe I want to hold a grudge about it. but regardless, I appreciate it, you know, when I, yes, Jimmy.
But that being the point, I mean, everybody has a vision.
Right.
So take it as what it is. I mean, it sometimes it's not good. Give the truth.
Sometimes yeah, yeah. your vision is terrible.
Sometimes it's great.
Sometimes it's good to be brutal. You know, I was 15 once too, and
sure.
and I look back at that stuff and I know I took it to shows and certain artists were very nice about it and stuff yeah, like that yeah. because they have no choice there. You confront them at the table. Maybe. It's not like they can walk away from you very easily. But you know that it's nice when someone does take the time.
It's amazing. I think it's incredibly helpful. And even if they're a little bit brutally honest, you need to work on this, you need to work on that. That's more helpful to me. I don't want some guy to say, oh, hey, this is great. I want to say, you know, your perspective here isn't very good, la, la, la. I mean, those are the kind of things I think you take away. And it really fires you up to go off and try to do something. When you get a pro talking to you, it always helps.
Did I tell you about the Dick Giordano story?
No.
When we talked on Comics Coast to Coast?
I don't think so.
I was in a portfolio line at ChicagoCon once, and I was drawing role playing games, but I wanted to be in comics, and so I'd stand in those dreaded portfolio lines, and I got up and I was talking to this editor, who was an editor of the Piranha line, Piranha Press, mm-hmm. which I think was a DC thing, back in the 80s, and I showed him my work, and he was like, this is really good. I think that you have some potential. I'd like to follow up on this. I want you to talk to Dick Giordano. He's going to be here in an hour. And tell him I sent you, gave me his card.
Cool.
I got really pumped.
Yeah.
I was like, wow. Hasn't happened before.
That's a great moment, yeah.
I've never been in the portfolio line and gotten anything but constructive criticism and no interest. And I went and I got in line for Dick Giordano, and I probably stood in line for an hour, and finally got up to Dick, and ooh, that sounded bad.
We can edit that out.
I showed him my stuff.
So, and he touched me.
So he looked at my work, and he was a brutal bastard.
Wow.
And he told me at the end of this little interview that it would be. He goes, I give you 10 years if you stick to it. And you work your ass off, it's going to take you 10 years to get into this industry.
Wow. Isn't that great? I love hearing that stuff.
I walked away, and I was madder than hell. Yeah. Actually, I was really dejected. Yeah. And then I got mad as hell. And I was like, I will show that son of a bitch.
Maybe that's why I did it. Maybe it was a mentor thing.
Dude, I've had thoughts about that. Here's the thing. For the longest time, I badmouthed him. I said he was a jackass. He was this. He was that. He doesn't know what he's doing.
Yeah.
And then I thought, but look what it did for me.
Yeah.
Look what a fire it lit under my ass.
I would like to think that he saw the talent and said, let's light a fire into this kid and see what happens.
You know, I got to think Dick's smarter than the average bear. Yeah. I mean, he was editor up there forever. He's seen 1,000 portfolios. Yeah. And so at the end of the day, I'm going to give him credit. Thank you, Dick.
My wife is an actress, and man, if you can't handle doors being slammed in your face, you have no desire. You shouldn't be out there doing this. So maybe that's part of, as an editor, he said, you're going to hear this. Someone is going to tell you, I don't care how good you are, that you suck.
2 years later, I broke into comics.
Yeah, there you go. So, I mean, it's you've got to have that skin. I mean, you've got to listen to what the pros say, but at the same time, you got to say, to hell with you, I'm doing what I want anyway. I mean, eventually, your own voice has to come out, too.
We got to get Jimmy a microphone for the next show. I want him in.
Jimmy's going to be the mascot. He'll be over there.
I want a third perspective. I think it'd be great. I'm serious. How much money? You got the money for another microphone?
Yeah, we'll buy another microphone. We'll fit it in.
Three-way. I don't have $100. No, you don't have to buy it. Well, we'll figure something out.
No, that's how much he's got to pay us to be on the show.
Oh, yeah, $600. That's what's going to cost you, Jack.
All right, turning to the film portion of our little show, because you have a ton of experience in film, and obviously I think we all, we talked about comics influences, comic strip influences, comic books, but films are huge influence on us. I mean, you know, from my earliest days, my parents were older. I'm the youngest of many boys, and I grew up watching old films, Errol Flynn. I mean, my favorite movie of all time still is The Adventures of Robin Hood, 1939. And that
Wolfgang Korngold
did the soundtrack and score. And the cinematography is amazing, the whole thing. I mean, it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And films, all, you know, Raiders of the Lost Ark, don't even get started on Star Wars and Blade Runner and all those things. So we are turning to film because we like film.
We love film, and that's what we're going to talk about.
As many
of you do.
Yes, exactly. I mean, how can you not talk about film? Because film and comic books right now are just totally in bed with each other because computer graphics have gotten to that point. I mean, the comics they did in the 70s and 80s, remember the Spider-Man TV show with the big web slinger things outside his thing and it was awful. And it was what was better than that was like the Electric Company Spider-Man. I mean, that Spider-Man was actually better than the TV show.
I actually hated Nicholas Hammond because I hated the Spider-Man thing so much. Blame the actor.
And we all thought it was really cool. Look, they're dragging him on a cable up the side of a building. That looks so cool.
I was like, he's shooting a rope out of that thing. What the hell is that?
How does he braid the rope as it comes out? That's amazing. He does macrame, too.
It's so disappointing.
So now, you know, obviously with movies, you know, Lord of the Rings, all these things, even Star Wars. But, I mean, nowadays with the computer graphics, they've gotten to the point where they can bring all these wonderful images to life. So I think comic books are obviously, I think, a gold mine to Hollywood in general. They look for anything that comes along. You were talking about something about the why we shouldn't be looking forward to, like, the Spider-Man sequels.
Right.
And I really wanted to talk about that. What was that thought?
Well, let me have this for a second. Is my whole note there?
No, I think it just says that, actually.
Well, you bastard. Well, I'd written, Tom wanted to put together a little bit of an outline so that we could have a little bit of solidarity on
just,
the show
just
here.
Just somewhat, you know.
And I'd written something like, back to him, like, maybe this is a good idea for a segment, why we shouldn't be excited to see things like Spider-Man 3. and I can't remember what the tail end of that one, but here, good God. I can't remember what the tail end of that that bit was, but the gist of it is this. Hollywood right now thinks that they spend a lot of time appealing to the lowest common denominator with the properties, with the product that they're putting out.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we you did find it.
Here's what it is. Why we shouldn't be excited about Spider-Man sequels, remakes, and crud that's pumped out for the lowest common denominator. There's a place for that content, but fans should demand more of their entertainment. Films we love, films we hate, and films we're looking forward to. But the fans demanding more of their content.
That's the point. Yeah. Fans should demand more. You know, if everyone rushes out and goes see this substandard thing,
mm-hmm.
and then it does well on DVD because people are just curious because, I mean, this is. I mean, we're talking about comics right now, so right. There's an audience there for it. And I understand that there's a lot of younger kids who are going to absolutely love the stuff, but you know what? I've grown up in comics.
Yeah.
And a lot of other people have too. And there has to be more out there for the more discerning viewer. I'm sick of having it spoon-fed. I'm sick of the one-liners. I'm sick of the formula.
Yeah.
It's very tired. I'm done with it.
Yeah.
You know, hey, maybe I'll take my daughter out one of these days and I'll go see Transformers and I'll look at it through her eyes and I'll be like, that was fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, like I said, there's a place for popcorn movies.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Man, I mean, it's just Ghost Rider.
Oh, man, yeah.
I don't see the point. And it cleaned up on DVD. And there'll probably be a sequel. And my question is, what the hell for? Why reward a film franchise for falling flat on its face?
Yeah.
It's crap. I don't want to see more. I'm not interested in seeing
more. Why was there Fantastic Four 2? I mean, Fantastic Four 1 was awful
horrible.
To me. I hated that film.
And yet I know kids
that
love that movie.
That is true. And that is, you can't get too far into that argument because obviously if that's the road they're taking, then fine. I mean, mm-hmm. If they've decided that that's their audience, the PG or almost G audience, well then fine. That's the different kind of movie that I won't expect very much. I mean, I'm excited about Iron Man because I think it's in the right hands. I love the casting. I love what I've seen so far. And it looks like they're treating it with the respect it deserves. But, you know, if Fantastic Four is going to go down the kiddie route, well, okay, fine. Then I just won't have to worry about it, you know, and that's just the way it is. But it just seems to me that they're just missing out on so much. And I mean, did you... Spider-Man 3, for me, was awful.
Yeah.
I mean, I loved 1, and I thought 2 was great, but...
I didn't see it, so it's not really that fair for me to comment on it.
Which one?
3.
Oh, really?
But I saw the trailer, which means I kind of essentially saw the movie.
Today it does mean that.
I'm so sick of that. Like, I don't need to see the story in 3 acts play out in a trailer.
Yeah.
I want to be teased. I want to... And if I have to feel cheated when I walk into the theater and I don't get what I want, so be it.
Right.
I'll be happy with that. Just don't feed it... Don't put it all out there for me to get, like, I remember the trailer for, was it John Q?
Yeah.
This Denzel Washington movie. I saw the movie when I saw the trailer.
Yeah. Yeah. They do that all the time.
Need to go see,
especially movies like that where you've already figured out the ending. Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot. That's good.
Yeah. And even if they're, it's that trick ending, it's that trick Q where they say, okay, well, you think it's going to end this way, then it's really not going
to. M. Night Shyamalan.
Well, what's the point of that? Yeah. No, I mean in the trailer.
Oh, in the trailer. Yeah.
No, okay. I'm a big fan of M. Night, yeah. Whereas a lot of people aren't, you know, like there are people who absolutely feel cheated by,
He's totally hit or miss for me.
By Signs or by The Village, yeah. And I just love it all. I'm a sucker that way.
Visually, I love it. I just think that, I really think that, for me, if I was his career guy, I'd say, do a romantic comedy or something, you know, because it's like now I've reached a point where I go see one of his movies and I'm analyzing it so hard to figure out what the twist is. I'm not enjoying the film
anymore.
That's
your fault.
It is my fault. But if every one of your movies is like that, that's a realistic expectation to go in and I'm thinking, well, gee, where's the twist coming from?
Well, I remember,
I want to see him mix it up. You know?
Well, I remember being disappointed by Unbreakable when I first saw it. Initially, I felt a slight,
I like that one right away.
I felt empty on it and I didn't know what to think of it. And then it wasn't until I saw it again that I really, really liked that.
Well,
movie.
That movie did get better for me over time. It was one of those things I walked out going, I think I like that. And then 3 days later, it was like, wow, that was really good. So
you here's know. The thing about Knight, in you know, from my perspective, a lot of you might be saying, well, Tim, you just said, you know, why make movies for the lowest common denominator? I mean, you're talking about getting cheated, and here's this guy that I think cheats his audiences with this stuff. I think there is a difference, and the difference is that M. Night writes for a more mature audience. His pictures, his movies, like them or not, they play out in a way that is very serious, very, very much to be taken seriously.
Yes,
as
he
a
does.
Dramatic.
I'll give him that all the time. Yeah,
and that's what I demand of some of the material that's coming out of the comics industry.
Right.
Not all of it. Not all of it. I'm not a harsh critic on that. I mean, I think that there's some stuff that demand to be a popcorn film, and there's some stuff that demand to be something more. The Punisher is one of those things.
How can you not do that with the Punisher? But they managed to do that
for a hard
Dolph,
R.
Then
make the movie right.
They should do it right. But the question is, now you say the fans should demand this kind of stuff. How much power do you think, honestly, the fans have? I mean, if the fans, aside from not going, because I mean the same argument is for, like, you know, everybody I know didn't like the last 3 Star Wars films and yet everybody went to them, and it's like crack, you know. I mean, everybody went and saw them.
Fans of the first one and kids alike felt, well, I think fans of the first one felt compelled to go to them,
yeah,
if for any other reason, to see if they'd get any better.
Right. Yeah. And that's funny to me, because now George Lucas can say, well, yeah, but my movies made $600 million at the box office and everyone hated them. Well, then we should not be going to the movies. But
there was the time that I worshiped at the altar of George Lucas.
Yeah.
And then he did the new Star Wars movies. I even stuck by him after Howard the Duck. But when he did the new Star Wars movies, and then he went back and he recut THX-1138. I pretty much was done with him at that
point. The man is a revisionist. He just wants to go back and fix everything. It's the weirdest thing.
He's like one of those
leave
painters,
it alone.
One of those painters that can't stop going back
and
painting,
like,
and trying
do
to
something
make
new.
It better.
Do something new, George.
He's 90 years old. He's still trying to make it better, and every step is just worse and worse and worse.
I've recast Star Wars with nothing but ferrets. It's amazing. You'll love it.
I think there's an audience for that.
Exactly. I'm sure there is. So.
But I just say demand more. You know, I mean, the question you just asked was,
do we have any power? The fans have
the
any
fans
power?
Have any power? And the answer to that is yes. And I think that it's unequivocally yes, because if the fans are the ones that are responsible for spending $70 million on Fantastic Four DVDs,
yeah, you've got no one to blame but yourself. Basically,
the money that they made on that made it possible to do a sequel.
Yeah.
Now I heard that the sequel's better. Which how could it not be?
Yeah, but that's sort of faint praise, you know. I mean, it's faint like, hey, you made a crappy movie. Now you made a slightly better crappy movie.
Well, I'm all about, when I go to see movies, finding a silver lining in something that may not be like The Fountain is a good example.
Mm-hmm.
To me, The Fountain is like it's a master painting on, but the canvas is a giant movie screen.
Mm.
It's art.
Yeah,
and for me, sometimes that's enough.
Yeah.
And I,
well, it's like a lot of Kubrick is like that. It's like some of, like 2001, you just sit back and just watch it.
Kubrick,
you
know, stuff succeeds just, across the board. Yeah. But
it's just so amazing to sit back and watch, you know, it's a beautiful.
The thing about,
Aronofsky.
And that film specifically is that it played for a week.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't open.
Yeah.
It's an art film.
Yeah.
It didn't open.
I would say, yeah.
Yeah,
from the Peanut Gallery, Aronofsky, the new Kubrick. Yeah. I could see that.
He very much is.
Same vein.
He's unfortunately not quite as accessible as Stanley was.
Yeah,
because Stanley knew enough to go to people like Arthur C. Clarke and Stephen King, and
completely changed their work.
Found material that was, sure, he completely changed it, but I mean, 2001 was a thing that, well, he co-wrote that thing with Arthur C. Clarke. I mean, not that he knew the science necessarily,
right?
But from a story perspective, from a narrative perspective,
yeah.
2001, you know, was an ongoing. They were writing it, you know, with the movie in mind.
Yeah,
it wasn't like there was a book and then there was a movie. So Kubrick had the good sense to work with good people that way.
Yeah.
Now Aronofsky, as a writer, writing his own material. You know, that's a harder road, but he's made it. And and I think he's a bona fide auteur, a bona fide genius.
Oh, just for Requiem for a Dream by itself. I mean, that movie, if you've ever thought about doing drugs, hey, pop that movie right in, baby.
Well, I think that The Fountain is very much along those lines, too. Yeah. And if you're too spoon-fed to get the story or to draw your own conclusions with what's going on in there, that's a sign.
Also, I think
that you're a popcorn watcher,
yeah.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's not a bad thing.
But why go see it if you know?
I just hate it when studios aren't giving anything a chance anymore. Now, I mean, it's gotten down to the point where they look at their spreadsheet, and if your movie hasn't made X amount of money in the first 17 minutes, they're going to pull it.
It's all like, about the opening.
You know,
now.
Yeah. I mean, Fountain could have probably run much longer and eventually found an audience. I mean, this is the same argument I could make about Firefly.
Yeah,
as like Fox just killed it. Because they put it out of order, they didn't give it a chance. Yeah, and it's just, and people have been complaining for years that it's like Blade Runner and then nothing after that in terms of like adult science fiction, smart science fiction.
Please, man. Tom, you remember when Blade Runner came out. Critics hated it.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, you look at any book from that period that rates movies, and Blade Runner would receive at best 2 stars.
Yeah.
And we'll go back to that over substance.
And the movies that people remember now from that time period are Blade Runner and Brazil.
Yeah.
And things like that were amazing visions that at the time people were like, I don't know, Blade Runner
took on a life of its own, and it wasn't only because of the visuals.
Right. No, exactly. It was a amazing film. But then there was this sort of like just blank spot there. You know, you thought that maybe this would be the return of adult science fiction where you actually had to think a little bit about something, but it doesn't really happen very often. And now, unfortunately, Hollywood has the ammunition to say, look, they put out The Fountain and it did nothing. So, you know, well, yeah, because you killed it.
Part of the problem is that that studio, it was Fox Searchlight. I can't remember who the studio is on that, but there comes a question in studio heads' minds as with a film like that, they couldn't say no to Aronofsky. He had the clout to do what he wanted to do, and he did it.
Yeah.
And this is the mistake that studio execs make. It's like, dude, don't give him the money if you don't believe in the project. Please, ever give the money if you don't believe in it.
Don't write a blank check. You know?
And no one ever learns this.
Yeah.
And thank God, actually, in a way, because you know we can still go rent them. We can still go to the theater that 1 week they open, or we can still drive to that city where it's the only place it's playing.
Yeah.
The important thing is that the filmmakers get to make their visions. And the thing about The Fountain is with the studio is they didn't know how to market it.
Yeah, that always, but isn't that like that? They always fall back on that. Well, we didn't know how to market it.
Well, it's true, though. I mean, they didn't get it.
Yeah.
So they didn't know how to market it.
Yeah. I know. Well, then just market Hugh Jackman in with his shirt off or something. Get behind.
I saw
get
promotion.
People in to come to see it.
I saw promotion. Well, see, that would be false advertising.
Yeah,
that would be misrepresenting the film.
Yeah.
I don't think you want to make that mistake either. What you do have to get across is that, okay, people, this isn't for everybody.
Right.
But the people that are interested in, please come out and see this movie. You know, there's so many metaphors in that movie. It's crazy. My other example of this is, I'm really upset about this right now, is that Danny Boyle's new film Sunshine was completely buried by the studio.
Yeah, which is one of the things I heard about all the time on all the boards and everything, and then it just sort of like, where is it? What happened?
Well, it's really strange because, you know, that's Fox, and Fox loves Danny Boyle. Yeah. 28 Days Later, which he only produced, that just came out, was a really nice little hit for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it not too long ago, and I thought it was very effective.
Mm-hmm.
A sequel that actually kind of, in a way, lived up to expectations for me. And I was really worried it wouldn't, which is maybe why I was, you know, I probably wasn't expecting much, and I got surprised, you know. I was excited that Robert Carlyle was going to be in it.
Yeah.
but it surprised me across the board. But Sunshine, Danny Boyle's new film, it's a science fiction.
Right, about this, they have to reignite the sun,
And, and it's Killian Hines. No, I'm thinking I'm confusing him with Ciarán Hines, the guy that played. Killian Murphy. Yeah, you know, he's such a riveting young actor, and you know, he's Danny Boyle's new Ewan McGregor.
Yeah.
You know, he's so great and interesting. He's got that James Spader quality where he's just like, he's interesting to listen to, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, kind of digressing, but Killian Murphy's in this movie. And he narrates the trailer, and the visuals are absolutely stunning.
Yeah.
If you see the trailer for this.
But ain't nothing blows up. That's the problem there.
Oh,
how do you market that?
Stuff
to
blows up.
Yeah, but that's not the way the marketing seemed to go. I mean, it seems, and that's what kills me about it, is that they can't market anything intelligent because I don't know if people want to see it. You know, I think it's like the death sentence to call something intelligent science fiction because the general public isn't going to go see it. They don't know how to market it.
I heard from a very close source who read the script that this person couldn't believe that Danny Boyle spent 2 years of his life working on it, which took the wind out of my sails a little bit. I mean, it didn't make me want to see the movie less. It just, I was like, why did you tell me that? I don't need to know that.
Damn it.
So I think that there were a lot of script problems with it, but I saw it and I thought it was awesome.
Cool.
I thought it was great, and so that makes me even more mad because here's what happened: Fox didn't know how to market it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think. Did you see a single TV trailer for it?
No.
Well, you wouldn't have because here's what happened: it was supposed to come out last March in the U.S. And it had already premiered in the U.K. and probably Europe. And I maybe it wasn't well received over there, and
I don't know.
Put the scare into people here. I don't know. I don't care. So it was supposed to come out in March, and they pushed it back to June or July. So June or July is getting close, and then there's another announcement. It's getting pushed back to September.
Yeah.
Me and several of my buddies are just really anticipating seeing this film. And ultimately, we got to September. And we're starting to talk about it because we're like, hey, it's supposed to come out any week now, right? You know, we've got to make a date to go see it. Then I get an email from a buddy who sends me a link that says Sunshine played in only 10 cities. They dumped it out to a few theaters in July, and it played for 1 week and left. They pulled a Tripper on it. That's basically what they did with the Tripper, too. But Tripper didn't have any kind of major distribution. So that, I mean, we knew that was going to happen to a certain extent on the Tripper, but I didn't expect it for a Danny Boyle film.
Yeah.
Especially a science fiction kind of, I guess it'd be stretching things to say epic, but because it's not that kind of a movie, but
it's big in scope
and it's a movie that you have to see on the big screen.
Yeah, that's the other thing.
And that's the most disappointing thing about it is because we didn't even get a shot to go see it.
Yeah.
Had I known that they released it to 10 cities, I probably would have felt compelled to drive up to Los Angeles and see it.
Yeah, I'm sure it was in L.A. for 20 minutes.
But, yeah, well, you know, it's 90 minutes to get up there, and I'd gladly done it to go see this film. But the fact that it just got dumped out, that's what angers me. It's no fanfare, no promotion whatsoever.
Somebody up at the top made a decision. They didn't want to sink the money into it, and they just said, well, goodbye. You know, then maybe we can get some Oscars out of it or something for special effects, and we'll release it in L.A. for 6 minutes. And
I think that if they could have promoted it a little bit and could have gotten people to it opening weekend, I think it could have been a marginal success, because I don't think it's the kind of a movie that you go see and you go, you tell your friends, oh, don't go see this. It's crap.
Right.
I didn't get that. Listen, I'm a pretty good judge. I'm not saying that my sensibilities are broad across the board going to compare to everybody else's, but I'm a pretty good judge.
You are the arbiter of taste.
And I can, you know, I can tell you, it's a solid film,
yeah.
You know, with some stunning visuals.
Yeah.
And really, you know, that's I'd rather see something that almost hits. And maybe doesn't succeed all the way.
At least makes that attempt.
And ultimately, even fails a little bit.
Yeah.
Than to go see the crap that's getting pushed out.
Yeah, I'd rather see somebody reaching for something unique and interesting and failing slightly at that.
I'd rather see the vision of an auteur on screen
right.
than go see what the latest video director did with his first feature.
Right, right.
On a remake. That's what I'm talking about.
Well,
so if you agree, fantastic.
I think you should definitely rent that film. Rent that film, put it on as big a screen as you can possibly get.
And seriously, if you want to follow this conversation up more, feel more than free, if I can plug my the Raw Forums here for
Let's
a second.
Plug.
Feel free to come over and talk about it on the Raw Forums. We have some threads open on that very subject.
And what is the website on the Raw?
Well, the very easy way to get to it is there's a link on my site for the Raw Forums in my links section, the left of the page, and my page is timbradstreet.typepad.com, and that's typepad.com.
And Raw Entertainment is over at www.rawstudios.com, so you can check things out over there, too.
And that's a real simple place to hit it, too, because right there at the top of the page, we have a menu, and it spells forum in big Indiana Jones letters.
And if you can't find that, we don't want to talk to you anyway.
Yeah. So. If you can't do the math there, then better luck next time.
That's right.
What? Yeah, I did. It's kind of Indiana Jones logo. Flair.
Yes, I noticed that. It's got the same kind of font there. So we wrap it up here pretty much. I mean, this has been great. This is our first podcast, and I'm sure we're going to do another one soon. And we will talk more about Raw Studios and various things. I'd like to talk more about Thomas Jane and his involvement in the whole thing. It's so cool to see an actor being this passionate about stuff, so I want to talk more about that.
Yeah, Tom's great. And you know, let's definitely, you know, let's do a little talking about The Mist.
That's right.
Frank Darabont's new movie, which they just premiered. They just screened it in New York to critics and...
Cool, so the reviews will be coming out soon. I've heard some very good things, so the behind-the-scenes stuff.
It played great from what I heard. Tom talked to Frank last night when they got back, or before they got back, and everyone was really high on it. So
excellent. I'll watch. That's another guy I'll go see pretty much anything he does, Frank Darabont, so there you go. And coming up this weekend, we have yours, Pittsburgh Steelers against the Toodles, San Francisco 49ers. How do you see this one coming out?
You know, normally I prefer not to bring my sports loves into the general populace because I'm not a trash talker. You know, I don't like, I never rub it in, you know, I try never to rub it in people's faces.
But you must be much happier this year. Ben Roethlisberger playing well. They're 2-0.
And I don't want to take any heat from Steeler haters. if you throw out some Steeler hate to me, just expect to be banned.
I'm not sure when this is going to be posted, but it is before the San Diego Chargers play the Green Bay Packers, my favorite team. And you know what? The Packers are going to take them down and go 3-0. You heard it here first. That's all I can say. So.
Just be prepared. The sports writers have you pegged to lose 8 more games before the thing's all over.
More than likely. So. And now turning to weather. No. Okay, that's it for the first podcast here of Tim and Tom. So thanks for listening, and we'll tune in again real soon.
I want to come up with a good sign off.
Good sign off. You're working on
good luck. No, wait. Good night. that's taken.
See ya.
What's the one from? Are we still on?
No, we're recording.
What's the one from? Leave that. I like that stuff. I appreciate that stuff when I'm listening. With like they think it's off.
Is this still on? Is it?
What's the one from the forget the name of it. The Ron Burgundy. What was
that? Anchorman.
Yeah,
I forget.
What's his sign off?
I forget what he said.
Looking good, San Diego. since we're in San Diego, that kind of I kind of almost want to steal his.
We could start off the show that way. Looking good, San Diego.
Looking good, feeling good, San Diego.
I was good. Bienvenidos a podcast de Tom and Tim. We do that first. We have to do that because we're near Tijuana.
Bienvenidos. So.
Bienvenidos a podcast.
So. Bienvenuta.
Okay.